Join us in just a minute for a special interview with Douglas Smith, who plays Marcus Isaacson on The Alienist.
You're tuning into the destination for TV superfan discussion, AfterBuzz TV. And now, let the buzz begin.
Miss Mary.
Hello, Alienist fans. We're bringing you creepy versions of childhood songs.
Right. Creepy.
I'm your host, 123 Jackie B, and we have a very special guest with us today, Douglas Smith, who plays Marcus Isaacson on the show. Say hi to the fans.
Hello.
You can find him on Twitter at Douglas the Smith. I got that right? Yeah. And is that your Instagram as well?
It's Douglas the Smithist on Instagram, because Douglas the Smith is my private Instagram.
Sorry. Didn't give anything away.
So let's have the rest of my panel introduce yourselves.
Hey guys, what's going on? It's me, Miss Candy Marie, and you can find me on Instagram at Miss Candy Marie and on Twitter at SweetCandora TV.
And hey guys, I'm Alice Ford, and you can find me on Twitter at Alice L. Ford and on Instagram at Alice's Adventures on Earth.
Yes, and I am Takira Shabray, and you can find me on Instagram and newly to Twitter at Takira_Shabray.
This song is still playing.
I'm so creeped out right now.
Keep the momentum going.
So, the main theme of tonight's episode to me was, what does it take to commit a murder? Because Kreisler seems to indicate to Sarah that we all have it in us to commit a murder. It's just a matter of circumstance. And that, psychologically, there are different views on that. Like, there are some people that believe, okay, you were born with a problem that caused you to be... I'm trying to think of the
like
name.
A psychopath or a sociopath.
Yeah, a sociopath. That was the word I was looking for.
Like the guy
for.
That kills dogs.
Right, exactly. Yes. Like you have something innately in you, but he believes that there, like, people can be pushed a certain way or another. And it does concern me about Kreisler, because I see this obsession where he almost, like, wants to put himself so much in the shoes of the killer that, like, he's thinking too closely like him, and I want him to take 10 steps back.
Well, you know what? He definitely needs to take some steps back, because he's pissing everybody off. You know, hey, he pissed me off because of some of the things that he was saying to some of the people. I'm like, you know, come on. Like, do you want to lose your team? Like, you guys are getting so close, and... He's hitting them where it hurts. Like,
Douglas, is the team pissed off at Kreisler right now?
I don't think the Isaacsons are, but I do
not
think...
Not the Isaacsons. Yeah. Maybe not yet.
No, yeah, but I think you're right about Sarah and John and Mary and... a lot of them, yeah. Yeah, the children, I think, are a little... nervous.
Did you see the way that child kicked that ball?
It was his mother's head.
This is the mother's head.
That was also disturbing, because I don't know how to feel about that, and I think that's how we're supposed to feel, because you hear, like, when you're a kid and you're angry, your parents are like, well, punch a pillow and it'll make you feel better. Or maybe that just happens to me.
My gymnastics coaches, like, whenever... they needed you to, like, go harder, they'd be like, pretend the person that you like the least is the springboard, and you're going to smash
it. There you go. So it was like, I feel like he was using an appropriate psychological tool, but just saying it was the mother's head went, like, a step too far.
Well, right. He didn't say it was the mother's head. He let the child decide.
He did let the child decide.
That's true.
He did. And I think what made us all kind of uneasy was Dr. Kreisler kind of had... he kind of got, like, a little bit of a passion of good job within himself when he was seeing the kid kick his mother's head against the wall. And even he took a kick at the ball. Mm-hmm. And so it makes you think, okay, what is Dr. Kreisler envisioning that ball to be? Because he kind of smiled a little bit. It was like a side smile when he was watching the boy, and he was like, like,
he
some type of pleasure. It was
me,
a little
uneasy. Kreisler is brilliant, but he lacks a certain level of self-awareness, because he's pointing out the flaws of everyone around him, and there's not this willingness to admit the flaws in himself. Mm-hmm. You really see that in that opening scene with the madam, where she's like, oh, you're aroused by this, by me talking about, like, pleasure and pain together. And he's so uncomfortable, he has to leave the room.
Well, he did actually admit it. He admitted that... when he heard her describing these situations with these other men, he was like, you know, I found the weakness within myself, and it brought me pleasure. So he did kind of, I mean, he admitted to us, I think that was the moment of him kind of coming to himself a little bit.
And you know what else she pointed out? His arm. She touched his arm.
We had a fan point that out, Tio, on our comments, which it's in the book, and I hadn't been looking for it in the series, and I was happy that they decided to
incorporate it. Which video?
On this last one.
Was it the last one?
He actually said, I was surprised that none of you ladies mentioned Chrysler's withered arm. I actually never noticed it until he said that. And then... I just thought
Mary did his shoes because he's like that kind of guy where you do my shoes, and now I'm like, oh, she does his shoes because
me too.
I don't know this whole pleasure about buttoning his boots. I mean, he can button his boots.
Don't forget he has that weak arm. So going back to that weak arm, you know, she pointed out the weak arm, and then we hear from Roosevelt about the weak arm as well. I feel like we're going to start to see more and more about this weak arm.
Yeah. And his vulnerability.
Exactly. So that's one vulnerability. And he obviously needs help. That's why Mary usually helps him, because he, I guess, maybe he can't do it himself because of that arm.
Right.
Let me ask you guys another question. Did you feel sympathetic to the woman who killed her children, who was pushing the empty pram?
I did.
I know that's a very weighty question.
I did. I actually took a note about that, and simply because when he talked about the pressure that's put on women to marry and to have children, I was sympathetic. Look, I want to clear this up, guys, for all the viewers out there. In no way am I saying that it is okay to kill a child.
It is not.
But
it is not.
For a second, I did kind of sympathize with her about the pressure that is put on our society. And I can't even imagine the type of pressure that was put on our society back then to have children. Because that's all that women were looked at back then, were just to bear children and to clean the house and just to be a wife.
Right.
So I feel like that was where my sympathy came from. I have no idea what kind of pressure was put on her by her family.
I think we
have no idea.
Yeah, and having a man with us this evening, I kind of saw you were giving, like, you were itching for it. Well, what was on your mind
in that scene right there with the pram?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel sympathy for her.
Murdered her children.
Yeah,
I maybe I'm not deep enough to go to that next level. At least while I was watching it, I just sort of. Oh, gosh, maybe sympathy. Maybe. I felt bad that she was that troubled. I guess that is sympathy, yeah. Maybe I did feel sympathy. Yeah, that's probably
Dr.
true.
Dr. Chrysler finds a way to bring it out of all of us.
Yeah, actually, now I'm going back there. Yeah, no, I didn't think that they needed to put her behind bars or anything. I was more thinking a different thing. I was more thinking, is that a metaphor for another case? You know, I wasn't really thinking too deeply into... this woman needs to be behind bars or anything. I was more thinking about, I guess I was coming at it more from the wealthy angle, the because someone has wealth, they're able to skirt the legal system.
That's another thing that's a theme in this show is you have these people with this incredible wealth, and then you have people who are immigrants, and we're finding out that the killer may or may not be someone who is from incredible wealth targeting immigrants.
Right. And in even the press were, you know, kind of pushing Teddy Roosevelt, like, you know, are you going to protect the poor or just the elite?
I'm not going to lie. I mean, it does make me a little bummed out that the press is depicted as vultures in every single episode.
In most movies, too.
Yeah.
They don't seem like vultures to me, because I like the actors who played the journalists. So, yeah.
Well, let's go back.
We know they're nice actors, and that's good.
One of them in particular, I spent a lot of my time with Jefferson. He plays Link Steffens, the one with the little mustache, the sort of reddish ginger hair. He's here, and he runs down the stairs. Yeah, so I guess I was like, oh, look at Jefferson. He's playing. He's doing good. He's doing good.
Oh, you're not seeing him as the press.
I mean, I was thinking, oh, what a great transformation, because it's a fake mustache, you know, and he totally transforms. He doesn't look really at all like that in real life.
He's good at playing that kind of aggressive character, like as far as like an aggressive press kind
of guy. Seems really good. We never had any scenes together, but we spent a lot of afternoons walking through Budapest where we shot it and drinking coffee and stuff. So it was actually a joy for me to watch him and see him perform. You know,
that's great.
That is really good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You brought up a really good
point. I would like to write down the clues. We get our first clue with your character, Douglas, actually, where you're on the roof of, I forget what that...
It's like the aquarium, or what it's going to be.
Castle Garden.
So where was that? Was that shot in Budapest?
That was actually shot on the... It's a fortress called Korom Fortress, and it's on the border of Hungary and Slovakia. So we drove about an hour outside of Budapest to the Hungary-Slovakia border. And so it was straddling it, the river. The fortress straddles both countries.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And so you guys are looking down at the side of the building. Now, was that an actual shot off the side of the building, or was that like a CGI thing?
That was a couple of things put together. They had an actual dangling shot off the side of the fortress. They also built a set at our stages in Budapest for when you're closer up. We're actually dangling off something that's not quite as high, and they did forced perspective. They cut between the real and the not real, and they did piece some of that together with green screen or whatever. I don't know what color the screens are these days.
Blue, green, white. Whatever.
Yeah. So it was an intercut, but it was a combination of both practical and special effects.
Are you afraid of heights?
No.
Oh, that's good.
No.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. No.
That's great. Well, so talking about that scene.
I know,
so
Alice is so happy because she called it. Because
you called that it was a climber.
Yeah, yeah. So like episode one, I think, we talked briefly about this, and I looked up some of the old tools they used to use for rock climbing, so I'm glad that...
They used pitons and things like that, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So. And that was exactly what... Yes. Douglas, Marcus.
I think you even talked about the Isaacson rope, too, bound. Because later in the episode, they find the piece of rope, which I am a terrible...
Wait, in the earlier episodes or this episode?
This episode.
Yeah, I was going to say.
This episode.
Yeah, because I find the rope on the roof. I
thought Alice had mentioned rope.
I did talk about it.
And then in this episode, your character found the piece of rope, and I was feeling so good. It was like, Alice.
Aha moment.
She's a detective. Yes.
Yeah, you're right.
I love it.
I did think, though, because my eyes aren't very good, I was like, they found a ball of hair! And then they're like, these are robots. And I'm like, okay. Yeah. I don't know what ball of hair would have done.
I thought it was hair, too. You know, okay. Don't feel bad. I was with you. I thought it
He's
was
like
hair
running.
Too.
The kids are ripping his hair out.
That's why the actors say lines.
Right.
To help me.
Just to make it very clear.
Yeah. And you finding the rope, this is... kind of our first time seeing your character kind of solo and investigating a crime scene.
Yeah,
so this is a big moment.
Why did you ditch your brother? Do you have
scary.
Like a backstory that you created for why you ditched him?
Well, it all starts with the book, and in the book they do separate because Marcus is a bit more of a go get him action type of person, and Lucius is more of a lab rat. They came from in the novel. It talks about their backstory, why they are doing what they're doing, and they both had different sort of heroes growing up. They're like, my character was obsessed with cowboy action novels.
Nice.
That's actually written into the novel, so that gave a nice grounds for.
That's good.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, in a TV show, you can't show as much in the novel, but it made it helpful to motivate why we were separating, and you will see more scenes where I kind of get buddied up with Luke or John, and Lucius hangs back with Dr. Kreisler. But I did miss my brother. An actor, it was weird because I had sort of set my performance off of him. He was almost like my, not mirror, whatever you call it when you compare everything, my measuring stick. I don't know. I was oriented around his performance. His performance informed my performance, and I think so. Being without him felt very naked, and I think that maybe is how a twin feels.
Oh, I'm sure.
Speaking of nakedness,
we talked about eating people now.
Well, no, not yet. I was going to go to your
He's
scene.
He's blushing,
you
guys. Come on.
Interesting.
Are you going to the sex scene?
To the naked scene, yes.
To the naked.
I'm so glad you're here because you cleared up a question we had in the last episode. Which was, which character were you sleeping with? And it turned out that it wasn't the prostitute that
John slept
that
with John.
Right. It was not Esther.
It was Esther.
Oh, it was Esther.
Esther is the name of the girl I saw at the on the street, and then followed to the socialist meeting.
Oh, the one beside the sign, and she kind of locked eyes and that sort of thing.
And then I follow her to the socialist meeting, and then she tells me her name's Esther because we're sleeping together, and I say, well, "What's your name?" And Marcus, and what's yours, Esther? Yeah, and so they get the hellos during the act.
Interesting.
And I don't mean to jump ahead, but I do like that at the end of this episode, your brother kind of gives you a Jewish guilt ribbing.
Oh, totally.
I like that character development because when you're building these. I like to call it Scooby Team because I used to watch Buffy when I was younger.
I watched Buffy too.
Yeah, so you're building like a Scooby Team and you have to get to know all of the personalities. So I like those little nuggets that they stick in where he's giving him the...
He's ripping on him.
And then Marcus is making some excuse.
Jokes about the Torah.
Yeah. He's so unbothered. He's like, I flirt the line. Whatever.
Yeah.
I like it. You're the risque brother, and we love your character. Fans like are raving over your character, and they're so excited that finally see you in that light. We had a few comment like, you know, when is he gonna get his moment? We want to get the backstory on him. So I'm glad the fans finally got that this week.
Yeah, there'll be more. I mean, it just sort of unfolds like a different layer of an onion every week.
Episode. We love it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we kind of saw everybody in their own, like, secularly, I think, in this episode. You know, everyone kind of had their alone time. I think everyone was also mad at Chrysler, so they all were like...
See, I'm mad at John Moore, because there was a moment where we were watching this episode when they go into, what was that place called? The Golden Rule?
The Golden Rule is where I meet him at.
And at first I thought John Moore had gone there alone, and like an episode or two ago I gave him such a ribbing for going into
the brothel by himself.
And I was like, he did not go into here by himself again. And then I was like, okay, he brought backup.
He didn't have any police training. You know, he's an illustrator.
Right.
So
you go and defend him.
Right. So he didn't go through the academy. You know, he doesn't have the same sort of training that the Isaacson brothers have. You know,
he's using what they call a street smarts over book smarts.
And he's also wealthy. He was brought up with a silver spoon. You know, he didn't ever even need to have street smarts. He had like finishing school smarts. You know,
he just has this edge, I guess, to him, and he just flies off the handle, I guess is what I'm.
Oh, with John?
With John.
Yeah, he does fly off the handle. For sure. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, he's like injured emotionally from his canceled engagement.
Julia.
And we really got that today because I think the reason we knew about that was because the actor, Luke, had given a lot of interviews about his character, so we knew a lot of that background. But in this episode, we actually get like the confirmation of it, and we get more of. Although I do think maybe Chrysler said something last episode.
Well, it kind of makes more sense now with the ring and like that whole exchange. Also, kind of makes a little bit more sense now, and like what Chrysler said today about just kind of the whole jealousy thing. So, like, maybe also the ring, aside from being collateral, is, like, also, like, he puts it on the woman that he sleeps with to make it some sort of, like, jealousy, reenactment of, like...
Role play.
Something like that.
I think we called that last episode, too. I mean, we are just, like, chock full of...
But I do think it also has to do with the episode's theme of, like, the pleasure mixed with pain.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because he's reenacting a moment that was very painful for him, because it also is intermingled with pleasurable memories as well. Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Chrysler says that number of times. And even the madam that he met with, if there's some type of vulnerability, then we feed on that, and we do it so much to get the pleasure from the pain over and over and over again. So John, Dr. Chrysler... You know, what does Sarah do? I feel like we'll all kind of.
I love her character, by the way. I love the madam character.
Oh, the madam. Oh, yes.
Yeah, she was good.
She was so.
It was a great scene.
Well, you guys just reminded me also of back with the baby scene with Sarah, and Chrysler was really like trying to use her own life against her in like that moment of being like, wouldn't you kill a child? really, that woman over there
yeah.
has everything you don't want. And right. what do you have to say about it?
He does so psychologically push buttons and
yeah, absolutely.
Plays with people.
Are you next?
So,
dun, dun, dun.
I don't think I'm supposed to talk about future episodes.
No, you're not. Yeah, it's a trick. You're very, you came prepared. I like it. And this may be, you know, on the pain, and I'm just curious, and one of our fans was as well, since we brought up Julia, John Moore's ex-fiance. Your cat's name is Julia. Random fact of the day, right?
Oh, yeah.
Did this come before or after The Alienist?
Oh, I've had the cat for a long time.
Okay. Yeah, how coincidental. It's yeah. just, you know.
Yeah, no, I've had the cat for over a decade. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. So much before, yeah.
We see the little Julia.
For,
I know, right?
Oh, yeah, she'll be there when I get home. Yeah.
And to go to the chat, Billie Jean, she actually has not watch any of our after shows, but she said that she saw that you were going to be on this, so she jumped on our chat today.
Oh, cool.
To ask you, how did you react when you found out that you got the role for the show?
I was what was happening? I remember I was happy and I was I was excited, and I specifically remember I was driving to audition for a role on The Incredible Kimmy Schmidt, is that what it's called? The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was going to tape. I have an office that I tape auditions for when the audition's in New York, and I was on my way, and I had actually taped the Alienist audition at that same office, you know, beforehand. And on my way there, I got the phone call that I got the role for The Alienist, so I didn't need to audition for Kimmy Schmidt, but I already had the time scheduled with these people, and so I went to a liquor store and got a 6-pack of Blue Moon, and I brought it to the session, and we and I told him, hey, you know, I don't need a tape, and we sat there and we drank a few beers.
Nice.
I remember that very specifically. Yeah,
a fun celebration.
Yeah, I was like driving. And, yeah, because you know I could have just been like call and cancel and be like, I don't need to come, but you know it was 15 minutes before I was supposed to tape, so I had to pay for the time anyway, so
right.
I thought it would be, buy them a beer for helping me get the job, you know.
That's amazing. Oh,
that well, really Billie Jean, there you have it.
I love that story. I just want to capture a couple more things before we move on to the interview portion, and please, if you guys in the chat roll have questions, keep them coming.
Yes.
I love to talk about the love quadrangles on this show, because they've set it up where Moore and Chrysler are kind of playing against each other, where Chrysler likes Sarah, but he also likes Mary, and he wants to have them both because he seems to be a person who's used to having everything he wants. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's like a correct assessment of him or not. And then John sees that Mary's upset about Chrysler being out with Sarah, and so he decides to take Mary with him to see the video? Edison's
Vitascope.
Yeah, I love that scene. Yeah.
I do too.
An early film projector. Mm-hmm. It was a real thing.
It's so cool. I love that they were so like jumping at water. It's a really cool scene.
I think, actually, I think this was my favorite episode because of all the historical tidbits, that and the dentist scene as well.
Yes,
I really love seeing the hand, the little boy pumping the thing that you spit into, you know,
right.
like the dental thing that we're so used to, you know.
And I love the touch how the guy still at the dentist, you still have all this stuff in your mouth and you can't talk, and he's coming in and asking him questions, and the guy's answering like, and the dentist is able to understand.
A night with Venus and a lifetime with Mercury.
Yes.
I don't know if I should be proud of myself or not, but the minute he said that, I was like, syphilis!
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh God, why do I know this?
Well, there were actually quite a few planet references in this episode. I don't know if that, like...
No, share!
Another one where Chrysler was talking to Moore in his house, and he, like, has a solar system, and he, like, spins it.
There's
another planet.
Yeah, in his office. It was in his office.
It was a really poetic episode. I think the director shot it really. It was a new director from the first three episodes. This was the first time somebody other than Jakob directed an episode.
Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, there were lots of like little tidbits that I really loved. Like, I also really love that, like, whenever Mary's upset, she just like vigorously is chopping vegetables.
Right. She's always chopping.
She shows.
She makes me nervous.
To not speak a word in these episodes, her way of getting her point across is very clear.
Oh, yes. I was going to ask you about that because, yeah, I've heard some people say she's not speaking. You know, she's mute.
Right. Yeah, I think in the book, we referenced it in the book, and obviously, like, the book,
and then I discovered that that was why.
Mm-hmm. Right. The first two, I think we weren't sure.
And I don't think a lot of people were sure. And it never occurred to me while we're making it. Yeah.
That people wouldn't really catch on. I think at first we had some thought that, you know, something in the past, you know, really affected her and she just stopped talking, I think that is it.
Yeah,
right. The murder of her father. Yeah. So we caught on at the third episode, like, why isn't she saying anything? And we finally caught on.
Because she did a few sign signals in this episode. I think that was helpful.
She signaled a thank you to John. I mean, that was extremely helpful. And so now we know.
Yeah, it's funny when you work on a show and you just know things because, well, in a book, like
the book too. Yeah.
They just tell you in, you know, the description line. But it's really interesting to see how other people digest the show and some things that you just sort of the knowledge that you take for granted, you're like, oh, wow, no, an audience doesn't know that until they know that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's interesting.
That's like, and obviously you don't have to speak to this, but when we have the man come in the end with the silver teeth, and that's the big reveal at the end of the episode, is that he's sent all the characters, our Scooby team, together.
I love what you called them, the Scooby team.
he sent the Scooby team together, and they all realize that he's watching them, which is like a certain level of creepy. And then at the end, we have a reveal with who we think is the killer, but we don't know for sure, because to me, he didn't seem to resemble the scene earlier.
The hands,
putting on gloves with mayonnaise because I didn't know what was in the jar.
So I think lotion.
So I wrote in my notes, I was like, putting on gloves with mayonnaise.
The lotion. And we had to, Alice and I had a moment where we was like, did you see that? Like, we had to compare hands, like, for the sneak peek in the next episode. And that's another clue that, you know, syphilis, because, you know, ulcers and things on your hands because, you know, back then penicillin hadn't. Yeah, warts and ulcers, because penicillin hadn't been discovered yet. It wasn't until 1928-ish. But yeah, like all of those signs of syphilis, like dementia, blindness, which one of our fans pointed out that she thought that the killer may have been blind. And I never thought of that. And when we heard this One Night with Venus, A Lifetime with Mercury, blindness actually is one of the, I don't really want to say the symptoms, but I guess syphilis is one of the causes of blindness, like back then. So that's really interesting.
Do you think that might be a reason why he's cutting out the eyes?
Right. And because the madam kept referencing if there's something that is vulnerable or something that we're not lacking. I think she specifically put it, the cripple, she called it a cripple, that the cripple in him is looking for the cripple in another. So that is such that's just piecing it together. You know, he's looking for all of these things that he maybe doesn't have that he's finding in others. So that's a really good point.
Yeah. And then I can't remember if it was her or Kreisler who theorized that if he had something in his past that affected him, and then he's reacting the opposite.
Yeah, I think Chrysler said that.
Yeah. I thought there were some really interesting questions raised about nature versus nurture.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, and we're still, episode. I mean, we know he, at this point, it's almost confirmed that he's a cannibal, so we...
I mean, the letter said so.
Is the letter telling the truth? I mean, that's the question.
Is it a riddle? Like, in my mind, I was thinking, is it a riddle? Because at first, it'd be too easy, right? Like, for the killer just to write the letter and brag. Although, we know he likes to showboat because he's now leaving his victims out in the open. He's writing letters. He's leaving things in clues. And he wants to he wants them to feel that he is where they are. So he loves a showboat, but then you're thinking, what else is it? Hashtag means something. I mean, like, there's more to it. So
yeah.
The other thing I thought was interesting about that whole letter scene is that the son, Mrs. Santorelli's son, tries to stop her from going to the police. And in my head, it was just a little thing where I was like, why is he doing that?
Well,
like,
because remember in the other episode, the police came and beat up the dad.
That's right.
You know, so, and they were like, don't.
I'm short term memory loss.
Don't worry. Someone else forgot.
Police are bad.
Yeah.
He doesn't want help from the police.
Right. Well, the chat is going off right now. They are, we have Nella, Kayla, and Elsa. Elsa. Elsa is saying the killer is just playing games.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree. I think he's definitely trying to rub it into the family's face, especially that poor mother that read that note. Because he talks about how he ate the child's ass.
Yeah.
And that was never talked about before.
So
that he ate the child's ass, or that any parts of the child's ass
he
was
said
removed.
He marinated it with onions and it fed him for
that
days.
That was just wrong. That was really, really wrong.
I was getting some Silence of the Lambs imagery going
on. That was bad. Kayla also said, she said, what about Chrysler smelling Mary's clothes? That was just weird.
Mm-hmm.
That was her clothes?
It was her clothes.
That was Mary's clothes.
That was Mary's clothes.
Her undergarment.
Yeah.
Which,
well,
I mean,
we all know that he really likes her.
Yeah, I think that's pretty
we called that last episode for sure. Yeah, it's really strange.
I mean, and I also think that he probably has some feelings of not really maybe being worthy because of his bum arm.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because he's not like a whole man to some other standard. So,
yeah, that's a good point.
Well, I'd like to move on and ask Douglas some questions if we can. My first question for you is, what was your favorite part about playing this role?
Well, I really liked the mystery when I first read the book. And I guess I really liked, I'm a bit of a history nerd, and I really, really like digging into the history of the time and getting together with the actor who played my brother and the director and sort of coming up with a character biography of when were we born? What was New York like for us, and what country did we come from? And that was really sort of fun, getting to know the characters. When you play a character in a period piece, you can't slack off on those kinds of questions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you play somebody in a contemporary piece, I'm not saying I always do slack off, but you may or may not slack off, and it was kind of exciting because you had to sort of raise your game, and it makes it more fulfilling. So that was a fun aspect of the job.
That's great. Do you have a favorite historical thing that you learned while you were filming this, like about New York history, or?
I like the Castle Gardens thing, actually. That was, I think, my favorite thing. I always thought about immigrants coming to New York and going through Ellis Island, but they came through Castle Gardens before that. And in our period of the show, it is in that in-between period when Castle Gardens has closed. It's no longer the immigration outpost for New York City, and it's turning into an aquarium. And I liked it personally because my great-grandfather, Theodore, came through Castle Gardens in like the 1870s.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
I was just gonna, that was going to be my follow-up question.
Oh,
so.
Yeah. So it was kind of interesting doing some own family research. Because I always knew my grandfather was born and raised in Brooklyn, but his father came from Germany, and we did the math, backed it up. And yeah, so that sort of castle that we're dangling off of was Castle Gardens, and that was where my family sort of, took their first steps onto soil in America. Yeah,
that's pretty powerful. So that's awesome.
That is powerful.
Do you have any fun set anecdotes for?
I mean, we were there for 6 months. It was for days and days and days. I know. I should have come with one that I like had memorized or something. There's a lot. Think about something fast.
Even something from that day, the filming of this episode.
Well, this episode was filmed over many, many, many weeks and months even. Come on, something funny. I'm going to think of it when I'm driving.
Yeah, like, feel free to, you could tweet us a little.
Maybe go to the next question, because I just don't have anything that I can honestly grapple, unless I can't think of anything. I'm sorry.
We can think on it. We'll get at the end of the show. I'm sure it'll come to you.
And we have another really good question from the chat. Billie Jean wants to know, what was it like wearing the clothing, and was it comfortable?
It was not comfortable, but it was a good way to travel back in time.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But I have some PTSD from watching some of the scenes today in particular. This was the scorching episode to shoot. Yeah, it was really hot.
Oh my gosh.
Really hot, like unbelievably hot.
Okay. We actually had some fans comment last week saying they really enjoyed just watching the episodes to see all the costumes. And we actually went to the Paley Center last week and actually saw some of the costumes, too, before the Super Bowl. So.
Right. Cool. Which is really cool that you get to tell us firsthand about your experience. Right. So that's a great way to tie in last week with this week.
Cool. They were beautiful to wear. And I liked wearing them at night and in the – but that whole sequence with me and John on the roof – it was really hot. It was really, really, really. It was, we were in L.A. It was hotter than L.A. It was like L.A. summer, but with New York humidity. It was like 100 degrees and humid, and and you're just running and you sort of like, the vision goes out a little,
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So
was it heavy? Were the clothes, were they heavy?
Oh, when the temperature was fine, no, they were actually really, really not, they felt really good. Our costume designer is a genius, and he measured every part of our body, like here, 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 wow. here, here, like everything. And it just fit actually really, really perfectly. So, it's not because of the clothes, maybe, because there was crew members in board shorts with no shirt on that were complaining about the heat, maybe I shouldn't blame the clothes. The clothes were a work of art, and they were just beautiful to wear, I really am amazed at the talent that was behind the wardrobe department. A lot of the stuff was made handmade by these seamstresses. They also made the dresses for Beauty and the Beast, so it was kind of funny.
That's a nice fun fact.
Yeah, because when we first started filming, Beauty and the Beast came out, and we were there, and so Luke rented out a theater for us to all go and see Beauty and the Beast, and the seamstresses who made all the dresses had to go right from Beauty and the Beast to work on our show, so they actually hadn't even seen the movie yet, because they couldn't go to the premiere, So we were sitting there, and they're like, there's Belle's dress. I made that.
I've seen those in person also. And, it makes sense that the same would make the clothing, the costumes for the show, because those, the gown and the suit was, phenomenal. The detail was amazing. Yeah. Amazing. So.
Yeah, they're really amazing. Amazing at what they do. Yeah.
I saw from your bio that you started, or that you've done theater. Did you start out in theater, or?
No, theater was more of a U-turn. Not a U-turn, a side sort of. I really started, I'm the son of a filmmaker, I really started in film and then did theater throughout elementary school and then did more professional theater while in between seasons of Big Love. And then after Big Love, I got a little bit more into theater, and I'm still always pursuing, plays and things of that nature. Yeah,
and you're screenwriting now too, right?
Yeah. Wait, who told you?
Yeah, we got the dirt.
We're alienists.
We're investigators, for crying out loud.
I started writing scenes back when I was in acting class, but then I sort of stopped for about half of my 20s, and now I've been trying to be a little bit more proactive at finishing ideas. So, I've been more dedicated. Wait, I'm really curious.
I do a lot of reading.
That's really funny. Yeah.
Nice. Well, looking forward to seeing great things from you, having you on the show again to talk about
these things. If you could play, this is one thing I'd like to finish with, though, with anybody I'm interviewing. If you could play any role, in the world, what would you play?
Well, I always wanted to do, it's kind of the... Do they talk about H.H. Holmes on this? He was actually a serial killer in Chicago around this time.
Yeah, they've mentioned him in the show.
Yeah, I've always wanted to play him For years and years, ever since I read that book that was about him, The Devil in the White City.
Oh, yeah. I read that one.
Yeah, I read it about 6 years ago, and I just started thinking about it, and I heard they were thinking about trying to make an epic movie, but I always thought it would be a really good character study where you sort of got behind why he did that, because he has some really weird writings that he made when he was in jail before he was executed. It's very weird because I actually have talked about that a lot. I remember when I did a play in New York, then a writer asked me that, and I had the same answer then, and then now I'm doing a show that takes place in the same time period, but it's a different story, but it's the same time period. It's in Chicago in 1893, so it 3 years before this show takes place. But I don't remember which one of you asked the question.
Oh, I did.
So yeah, I'm looking at the right person. Okay. Yeah, I always thought, I don't know, that would make a really interesting character study.
And it sounds like because you've already done a lot of research for this role, that you could go to somebody and be like, look, I already did all this.
Right, you can I just need to write the story.
I always wanted to play Chet Baker, but then Ethan Hawke did it so well. You know Chet Baker, the jazz, you know, the cool jazz singer and trumpet player?
I've heard of him.
Yeah, I always thought that would be really fun, but Ethan Hawke was in a really good Chet Baker bio movie that came out like last year, and so I don't really think the world needs another one. I don't think the world needs another Chet Baker movie, you know, that soon. So I'm sort of kissing that one goodbye.
Yeah. All of your or not all of them, but it's your kind of interest in forensics and history that shows, because I mean obviously you've done, you know, CSI, you're doing this.
I've done a lot of those.
That's kind of a trend. And so I, you know, to see something on screen that you've done or written, then it wouldn't surprise me. It's kind of be interested to see it. But that's something that I'm assuming that you kind of have a thing for.
Yeah, I'm not a creep or anything.
Like true crime is fascinating.
Yeah,
that's why so many people listen to Serial. You know?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That was a huge phenomenon. Yeah, I remember when the first season of that came out. Yeah, that was. Yeah, I couldn't stop listening to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just one. I mean, I think of like a lot of top selling books and a lot of like the Capote, In Cold Blood. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of them.
In Cold Blood. Yeah.
A lot of them are true crime stories. So it's just from a, like, to tie it all in, from a psychological perspective, we're, like, interested in our own, studying our own natures.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, absolutely.
Before we go, we have to wrap this up, but I wanted to remind the viewers about our giveaway. Alice, can you remind them of
where to go? Guys, remember, we are doing a giveaway. We're going to be giving out 4 of the novels, The Alienist. And to enter, there is actually a link in the description of this YouTube video. So all you have to do is click on that link. It's going to take you to a new page, follow the directions. And then don't forget to put a comment on either this video or one of the other episodes. And or you can also comment or write a review on our iTunes on the podcast. And then once you do that and then enter on the link, then you'll be entered and we're going to make a drawing out of a hat for the winner.
A vintage hat.
That's right. And is there a fan of the week this week?
Yeah, fan of the week. We actually...
every week we do a shout out to a fan of the week.
Oh, cool.
We already kind of mentioned him, Tio Baracho. I hope I'm saying your name correctly, but he was the one that was mentioned about the withered arm, so he kind of brought that to fruition, and then also said, similar to what we had talked about last week, that it makes him miss the Nick and Penny Dreadful. Which I totally loved both those shows too, so I feel you on that one.
We get that a lot, actually. We've had a couple of people comment that.
One of the things that is super fun for the fans and for us about the show, I think, is because I'm like halfway through the book, and then they haven't read it yet.
Yeah, but I'm starting. I think on page like 92, if I'm not mistaken.
I did that on purpose because I don't want to know who the killer is.
I know. I was going to say I would almost recommend waiting until you finish the show, because it might confuse things.
I'm actually stopping as the episodes go, so I'll read up and I'll be like, oh, that's beyond what I have seen, so I'm stopping.
It's
a very exciting way to read it, because you learn all those background details, like why Mary wasn't talking. Mm-hmm. But then you get to still, with all the fans and here, we get to still ruminate over who's the killer and what do these things mean.
Nice.
Right. And I think last time you were about there, and I was like trying to catch up with where you are so I could do kind of the same thing, but no spoilers. So
yeah, we don't want to give spoilers.
No
here.
Spoilers.
It's a spoiler-free zone.
Spoil-free zone.
Do you have anything else you would want to promote or anything?
No.
Just keep watching The Alienist.
Yeah.
And then tune in here afterwards. You can find me, 123 Jackie B, on all platforms. Ladies, where can the people find you?
Yes, you guys can find me on Instagram at Miss Candy Marie and on Twitter at SweetKindorTV.
And you can find me at Alice L. Ford on Twitter or Alice's Adventures on Earth on Instagram. And if anyone out there is writing a script about H.H. Holmes, we've got a great actor for you.
Absolutely. And you can find me, Takira Shabre, at Takira_Shabre on Instagram and newly to Twitter.
Yay! And Douglas, they can find you at Douglas the Smith on Twitter.
Uh-huh.
And then at Douglas the Smith something else.
Smithist.
Yeah, I'm the most Smith there. Yeah, Douglas the Smithist. Yeah.
Douglas the Smithist on Instagram.
Yeah,
thank you guys
Instagram,
for joining.
We
hope you enjoyed this interview, and we hope you tune in next week for our recap of the next episode of The Alienist.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz, see you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.